welcome to Film Fragments, a podcast where we take fragments of an actor, director, and genre and tell you our favorites from their catalog. My name is Brian Suffield. I'm your host, and I'm very excited to welcome you guys to this week's episode of Film Fragments, where today we're going to be talking about our favorite threequels. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 hits theaters this weekend, so I thought it'd be a perfect opportunity to talk about our favorite third installments in film series, also known as the threequels. I am super excited to get into this list. There are a lot of really great third installments to talk about, and I'm very excited to welcome today's guest. He is a Los Angeles-based writer, critic, and an occasional actor, songwriter, comedian. Some of his bylines include Slash Film, Crooked Marquee, Daily Grindhouse, Polygon, and Bloody Disgusting. It is such an honor to welcome Bill Bria to Film Fragments. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Brian. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being on. I'm super excited to be talking to you today. But before we get into talking about our topic, I would just love for you to tell the audience a little bit about yourself. Talk about what you do, what got you into film, and why you love it so much.
Ooh, what got me into film? Gosh, I can remember wandering around my family's basement back in Ann Arbor, Michigan when I was growing up with a hockey stick and reciting the entirety of Ghostbusters line for line. And my family would look at me like, what the hell are you doing? And I'd be like, I'm playing Ghostbusters. Like, you know, normal kids, when they play something, they use the action figures, they do whatever, you know. Your idea of playing Ghostbusters was reciting the movie. Okay, we figure out what you're thinking about there, kid. So yeah, it wasn't too long until I got into acting in high school and did a lot of plays and that sort of thing. But that entire time, I was discovering film. I was discovering not just, you know, stuff like Star Wars and the classics, you know, from everything from the Marx Brothers on. But I also really got into horror, which is, I was a real, you know, scaredy cat when it came to horror for a long time, where I would refuse to even walk down the aisle in the VHS, you know, boxes in the store. Because the box art would scare me. But, you know, once I saw The Evil Dead, I was out. I was good. I was like, I understand this genre now. I'm going to go full bore into it. Yeah, and like just all the way through college, you know, kind of living in the library for a while and reading just stacks of, you know, these books of criticisms that they had from like the 80s. I remember reading a review of Aliens, and I wish to God I could remember the name of the critic, but I remember the first paragraph, they were like, okay, so when they're on the Sulaco and Aliens, it's like they're in the mother's womb. And this whole movie is about motherhood. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, so I remember all those like milestone moments that just got me on this path. I took a film minor in college and, you know, just had my mind expanded further with, you know, David Lynch and a lot of other independent, crazy filmmakers there. And then I got into criticism around late, a little around 2015, after I had my liver transplant. And, you know, I kind of needed to regroup and figure out what I was going to do because acting was not, you know, as feasible as it was before. And, yeah, and I just started, you know, writing for some friends and their own personal websites for a while, kept plugging at it. And then today, like you just said, I've been working with Slash Film for the last couple of years. I do co-host my own podcast on the horror genre, Bill and Ashley's Terror Theater on the Stranded Panda Network. You know, I'm continuing to freelance and contribute to a lot of other sites as well, as you mentioned. And, it's just something that, you know, I love movies to such a huge, weird degree. I'm the guy who watches every DVD special feature ever since DVDs started coming out. So, I just want to share that love with as many people as possible.
Definitely. Absolutely. And, you know, going into our topic today, threequels, obviously the definition of a threequel is a third installment, and most of the time it's a way to cap off a film trilogy, but there have obviously been some franchises we've gone that have gone past the third installment. So what to you makes a great threequel? I know that basically it's like, oh, what makes a good film? There's nothing super significant about threequels, but what do you specifically look for in a third installment of a franchise?
Well, I did want to say this because it's corny, but it's true. My name is actually, my full legal name is William F. Bria III. I am a third.
Now this is very fitting that you're this on. Now it makes sense.
That's as soon as you said it, I was like, all right, I know how to play this angle, but I felt this truly all my life that I am a threequel myself. So, and you know, my father was a doctor. His father was a doctor. I am obviously not. So you know, you already have that built-in expected disappointment. in a threequel of like, oh, this isn't what we thought it was supposed to be. But in my view, I feel like that's a plus. I feel like, hey, I'm my own unique person. I've got a lot more to offer than what you might have expected. And, you know, I'm taking the story in this interesting new direction. So that's typically what I feel a great threequel makes. It depends. I do, and you'll see in my list, I'm sure, but there is a distinction for me between, say, a threequel and a part three that we knew was coming. In terms, and not even in terms of like, oh, the movie made money, we know there's a part three coming. I mean in terms of like, there's already 20, you know, books or something, and this is book three of 20, you know. So I do think those are still counted as part threes. They still technically are. But I think it's interesting in a franchise, you know, way of, okay, we expected to not make more than one movie. We made a second movie. It did really well. Oh, crap, we got to make this third one. And I think that's really, some really interesting things can get into the sauce. And I know that's things that some people do not love, but it's a lot of things that I love.
Absolutely. When it comes to franchise films, some of the best films are their third installments because, like I said, some of them wrap up their franchises with the third film. Sometimes they go beyond the third film and the stakes could be higher, the characters could be more developed, the journeys could be more expansive. We never know what's going to happen with a threequel, and I think the five films that I put on my top five list, they're all so different from one another. Like, literally every single one of these films are different from one another. Some of them are conclusions to a film series. Some of them are the halfway point for a series. It's very, very interesting to see where you could go with a threequel. So I just say, without further ado, let's get into our list. Our top five favorite threequels. So, all Bill, right, what is your number five favorite threequel?
Number five, I'm already jumping right into controversy, as most of these probably are. But I'm going with Godfather Part 3. And the reason for that is, and the more I watch this film, the more I find to admire in it. Now, obviously, famously, after Godfather Part 2 in 74, you know, Coppola and Puzo had pretty much exhausted the source novel. And, you know, what new material he'd added to Part 2 was pretty brilliant by itself. So everyone was kind of assuming, including Coppola, like, this is over, we're done, there's no more. Of course, you know, the troubles that he was having as a filmmaker in his career during the 80s, you know, started to allow this idea that Paramount was pushing, like, we should make another one, we should make another one. And, you know, there were all these crazy, obvious ideas that Paramount was throwing around, like, oh, it should be the son of Sonny, and, you know, he's running around killing folks. Isn't that great? But I really enjoy what Coppola did with Part 3 in terms of turning it into... Now, as we may have known, or as you may have heard, he recut it and called it a different name, The Godfather Coda, The Death of Michael Corleone, which is a really unwieldy title. It's a cute title, but it's very long. but it is appropriate in the sense that Part 3 does act as this extended denouement from the first two films of, okay, here's this guy who rose his way, you know, fought his way to the top, did like the most despicable shit that you can think of to himself, his family, people he supposedly loved, as well as his enemies. And, you know, what's that guy got left at the end of his life? And, you know, in Coppola's mind, it was, well, he's trying to put together his family again, try to make some sense of everything he's done in his life, trying to leave some sort of legacy, you know, behind. And he can't do it because he's made such a poison out of everything. And the people that get punished the most are not him, but the people around him, including a certain character who's killed at the very end. And, you know, it's this real, like, poke in the eye of Michael Corleone of, like, this is what you deserve. This is what you've built over the course of your life. And now you're going to get this punishment, which isn't so obvious as, like, oh, you're going to get whacked, you know, or, oh, you're going to get tortured. Or, you know, it's going to be this real slow bleed of a tragedy, which is kind of, you know, fitting, I think.
Yeah, so I've only seen The Godfather Part 3 once so long ago, and obviously it's not on the same level as the first two. I think a lot of people agree with that. It's obviously the weakest one, but I mean, you're comparing two masterpieces to a not masterpiece, and I know that The Godfather 3 has gained this kind of cold following over the last few years, especially since Coppola recut the film and everything. I have not seen the new cut of the movie. I'm sure it's better than the theatrical cut. I cannot comment on that, but I do admire the swings that The Godfather 3 took, but at the same time, you know, he couldn't recapture what he did so beautifully with those first two films. So I feel like it's not regarded as the worst threequel, but it's definitely not regarded as one of the best either. So I think it's very interesting that you put it on your top five list. And my number five is a completely different film from The Godfather Part Three. My number five is Logan from 2017, which I personally, and this is just my opinion, I know that everyone is going to be like, what the fuck when I say this. This to me, and this is just my opinion, is the best superhero film I've ever seen. Now, let me just say that I love the movie involving the bat. I love that movie. It's great. It's fantastic. But what James Mangold was able to do by capping off Hugh Jackman's tenure as Wolverine in such an emotional way, I did not expect this film to go into the directions that it went into. Because you watch this film, you tend to forget that it's, you know, a comic book superhero film. You tend to think of this as just like sort of a Western of sorts. And there's so much emotional gravitas to this movie. It's very subdued. It's very focused on the characters more so than the action and the fight sequences and everything. This is a character-driven story that is handled so beautifully through its direction, its screenplay, and its award-worthy performances. Hugh Jackman as Wolverine has always been fantastic. He's always been a highlight of the comic book movie genre. Obviously, even in the bad films, he always found a way to elevate the material. But in Logan, he goes places that we had never seen that character go. He's broken. He's slowly losing his ability to heal. He's losing his powers. And he's just given up. After everything that went down with all his friends gone and the world being completely different and there being barely any more mutants, it's a really emotional road trip movie. And Patrick Stewart in this film, I think he should have been nominated for an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. I really, truly believe that he gave one of the best performances that entire year as a broken, hopeless Professor X. Like, again, we had never seen that side of him before. So to see him go to the places that he went to with his disease, with his illness, I was shocked. And Daphne Keene, what a great debut performance for her. One of the best child performances that I've seen in the past decade. I remember really being an emotional wreck when I walked out of Logan. It went places that I wasn't expecting. It sent off the character beautifully. It got Oscar nominated for Best Screenplay, which made this the first live-action superhero film to receive a nomination for its screenplay, which was a really incredible honor. And it should have gotten more love. It really should have gotten more love that award season, because that was one of the best films of that entire year. It was in my top five for the entire year. It came out in March of 2017, and for 9 months it stayed in my top five. And that's saying a lot. And that was a really solid year for film. There were a lot of great pieces that came out that year. Some of my favorite films of all time came out that year, and Good Time, Call Me By Your Name, Lady Bird, but what James Mangold did with Logan was on a whole other level. And that's the reason why I'm so excited to see the new Indiana Jones, because if he's able to send off Indiana Jones the way he sent off Logan, we're in for a ride. And I have a feeling that that's going to end the Indiana Jones saga with a bang. Logan is one of the best trilogy conclusions ever. It's one of the best threequels ever. It's such a fantastic film. No film in the superhero genre has topped this for me. I love it so much. Logan is my number five. Are you going to pass, or is this not on your list?
It's not on my list. It's funny because I didn't even while you were just starting to discuss it, I was like, is Logan a part three? Because you can do a different sort of math and think of it as a part, 14 or something, if you include all the X-Men films and, you know, every movie that he appeared in beforehand, which it doesn't, you know, what's the word I want? It doesn't disregard, even though I finally figured it out. I was like, oh, right, because there was Origins and the Wolverine and Logan. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the movie's weight is really just tremendous. And like you were saying, it's a really fantastic film. But yeah, I didn't think of it as a threequel, so it's not on my list.
Yeah, it's so good. And I just don't know if I'll ever see a superhero film better than this. And I understand why a lot of people consider The Dark Knight to be the best comic book superhero film ever made. I totally understand that. But to me, this did not feel like a superhero film at all, because it, like I said, focused so much more on the characters than the scope. And there was a lot more action in The Dark Knight than there was in this. And when you got to the action in this, it was very elevated and really, really anxiety inducing. Yeah, it's incredible stuff. And, you know, it's sad that the Hugh Jackman film from 2017 that got award buzz was not this, and it was instead The Greatest Showman, which I don't really like that movie. I like him in it, but I don't like that movie at all. So that's unfortunate that we were in that state. So now going into our number fours, what is your pick?
Well, it's another weird one. And if you didn't already know, I am a huge horror guy. I could have filled this entire list with horror if I'd wanted to. I didn't. This is the only horror pick, but it is, I feel, the one that draws the biggest controversy and debate about in the horror world about threequels, which is Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. And of course, that's the one that infamously does not have Michael Myers at all, except in a single scene where, well, two scenes where Halloween's playing on television. But it is famously the one where producers, John Carpenter and Deborah Hill, were attempting to end the Michael Myers saga after one and two, and thought, oh, let's take the concept of Halloween and let's parlay it into an anthology series where every October we're going to make a different horror movie set around or about Halloween, probably with a different filmmaker. And wouldn't that be great? We can just have this franchise go on for decades and decades. Well, best laid plans did not work out because people went to see Halloween 3. In 1882, I kind of understand when, you know, there was no real internet climate where you couldn't easily go online and go, hey, what's Halloween 3 about? You know, you would go to the theater and go, wait, where the hell's Michael Myers? So I understand that people were definitely sent off the obvious path there, because this is not at all the same kind of story. It's barely a slasher. It's really more of a kind of a mix between Invasion of the Body Snatchers and the Quatermass Experiment, where it turns out there's this creepy company making a bunch of Halloween masks that, when activated by a certain TV signal, will disintegrate someone's head and send bugs out to, you know, populate the Earth. Essentially causing a mass apocalypse at the same time. A doctor happens to stumble onto the plot, played by Tom Atkins as a boozy womanizer. And, you know, they go up to this small town and investigate and get involved in the conspiracy and so on and so forth. So it's definitely a little bit of a throwback movie to kind of a 50s kind of B movie sci-fi, but at the same time, got some gory horror moments from the 80s. It's got a great pervasive kind of mood of dread. It is, of course, the only movie in the Halloween series that it's its own beast, you know, where it's just, even though there's different weirdness going on in the later sequels, you know, depending on which producer's cut of Halloween 6 you watch, there are runes involved or some nonsense. But yeah, this is the only Halloween movie that you can say, you know, is its own thing. And it's something that I, you know, just enjoy for its originality.
So I have not seen Halloween 3 Season of the Witch because of how polarizing it's been for literally everyone these last 40 years. I also am not super well-rounded with the Halloween franchise. Like, I've seen the original. I love it. It's one of my favorite horror films of all time. I liked the 2018 movie. Kills was whatever for what it was, and I hated Halloween Ends. I hated it. I'm sorry to everyone out there that enjoyed it, but this guy
Another
right here
threequel.
really did
Another
not like
threequel.
another threequel and a terrible threequel that hopefully will not be on anyone's list of top five threequels. I'm sure it's on somebody's list, but yeah, when I heard that Halloween 3 didn't have Michael Myers, it kind of interests me because I never realized that John Carpenter and Deborah Hill were trying to go for an anthology approach to the series, which I think is really, really cool. But then people are like, we want Michael Myers to come back. And then they made all the subsequent sequels following that. And then, you know,
And now he'll never die,
yeah, now he'll never die. And in 5 years, we'll probably get another Halloween movie, which. Whatever, and then it will erase everything that happened, and then it will do the whole timeline cleanse thing again, retcon and everything again. Which, God, no, can we just not do that anymore, please? I'm sorry to everyone out there that loves Halloween, but I just can't do it. But yeah, I would love to watch it. I think that I might finally bite the bullet this Halloween and watch it for the first time
Yeah,
just
give
to
it a
like get it
shot.
out of the way. I just need to see. If I'm gonna be someone that's a fan of this or someone who isn't a fan of this, because there are devoted fans, you're obviously one of them, and then there are people that are very vocal about not enjoying this movie.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm curious to see where I'm gonna land on it, so we'll have to cross that path when I get to it. But my number four, I'm going to go with Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. I'm a huge Harry Potter fan. It's my favorite franchise of all time, which is kind of crazy that this is not my number one. I think in terms of threequels, this is not the best threequel, but this is one of my favorites for sure. I, being the big Potter fan that I am, I know it's hard to be a Harry Potter fan right now with everything that's going on, but I will always love this series, especially for how it shaped my love for film as a child. Like, I literally grew up with these books, with these films, and Prisoner of Azkaban is considered by a lot of people to be their favorite in the series because of the directions that it went. Now, when you watch those first two Harry Potter movies, they're obviously very kid-friendly. They have their dark moments, but they're more family-oriented for sure. They're very lovely, but also the kids were super young. Now we get to Prisoner of Azkaban. They're 13. They're now teenagers. And things get a lot darker for them. And this movie is so dark. Like, you watch the first two back-to-back, and then you see this, and you would not even think they're in the same series because they're so different from one another. Now, you had Chris Columbus direct the first two films, the guy who made the Home Alone films and Mrs. Doubtfire. He made all these lovely family films from the 90s. But then you bring on an auteur like Alfonso Cuarón to helm this. He had made A Little Princess. He did Y Tu Mamá También. He was very big outside the United States. So then Warner Brothers bringing on someone like Cuarón to helm this film was really exciting. And my God, the places that this film goes is really, really impressive. The scope is brilliant. The direction is absolutely wonderful. Some of the best imagery in the Harry Potter franchise is on display from this film. What Cuarón is able to utilize here by making it very dark and grimy, even in the sequences that are set inside during the daytime, like in the classes and the Great Hall and everything, like there's just something very eerie about where this story goes. And the book was never my favorite, but I think the movie is my second favorite of the entire series because of what Cuarón is able to do. The stakes are very high, and the performances, of course, from Daniel Radcliffe, Rupert Grint, and Emma Watson, they're all great. They were great the entire series, but I think bringing on David Flowis as Lupin, that was a great addition. But Gary Oldman as Sirius Black is one of the highlights of the entire series. And I think the way they introduce his character is really, really remarkable. And when you have an actor like Gary Oldman, who is such a legend, he is one of the best actors ever. Like, I feel like everybody knows who he is, but I feel like he's still kind of an underrated actor, even though he has an Oscar win. It's like, you talk about some of the great actors of our time, not many people talk about Gary Oldman, which is such a shame because he's done practically everything. He's done literally everything. And he's been in so many multiple franchises. I mean, the fact that he was in Harry Potter and the Dark Knight trilogy and the Planet of the Apes franchise. Like, he's done so many different franchises. The guy is a chameleon of an actor. He's one of the greats that we have ever received. And one of my favorite sequences in the entire franchise is when they're in the Whomping Willow and they come across Sirius Black and Harry faces him for the first time and he really wants to kill him. And then Sirius just has this moment where he screams, like, I've done my time, 12 years of it. Like, the heartbreak in his voice. In Azkaban! It's so heartbreaking to watch. It's really incredible work. And yeah, I love the places that this film goes. And it definitely sets in stone for where the franchise is going to go, of how it gets darker. It's obviously steering away from the likable charm. Like, yes, you still have some of the funny moments incorporated in this film. You have them in all these films. But I really love how this set in stone for where the series was going to go from here on out. I love Prisoner of Azkaban. I get why it's a lot of people's favorite in the series. And the Dementors, even as a 25-year-old, still scare the bejesus out of me. That train sequence where we're first introduced to them, that's still a terrifying scene. That's terrifying than some of the horror movies that we get nowadays. And this movie's rated PG. I mean, that the power of great filming right there. Alfonso Cuarón is a genius. Has yet to make a dud, in my opinion. I love all of his movies. I need him to make another film again soon. That is my number four. Are you going to pass, or is this not on your list?
It's not on my list because of what I said earlier. I consider this a threequel in the book series in terms of, like, it's part of the series. We knew it was coming. It, you know, it was almost a done deal as soon as, you know, the first two Harry Potters were such a smash. So that's why it didn't enter my head in the same way that Lord of the Rings didn't enter my head either. You know, even though Return of the King is a friggin' masterpiece in my mind. So, you know, it's not on the list, but you're Yeah, I love your argument for it. And Cuarón is, you know, he's part of the Three Amigos, you know, him and Del Toro and, oh my God, what did I just...
Iñárritu.
Iñárritu, thank you. So, you know, and I love that those guys are friends. I love that, you know, their films are so different from each other, but they, you know, have this, they make up this really excellent, you know, three corners of Mexican, modern Mexican cinema. So, yeah, I think that Azkaban was the first Harry Potter movie to announce itself as like, oh, these movies are, they mean business, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love how the Harry Potter series has obviously focused on delivering beautiful scope, but it also focuses so much on the characters, and that's the thing with some of these franchises is that they're so focused on the style that they don't care so much about the substance. Harry Potter finds a way of balancing the two, and you could see the effort placed into both of them, which I really, really appreciate because I feel a lot of blockbuster franchises, and I don't know if you feel this way, I feel that a lot of blockbuster franchises lack that, where they focus so much on the style but never the substance. But I really appreciate that all eight of these Harry Potter movies have a great balance of focusing on both of them.
Yeah, yeah.
So now our number threes. What is your pick?
Well, I know you've seen this, so you might hate me for even invoking its name or not. We'll find out. It's Spider-Man 3. For a certain generation, just saying that name, you know, there's already a revulsion going, oh, oh. But I do feel like we were saying about Godfather earlier, its clout has risen a little bit in recent years. And, you know, especially with Sam Raimi still being a cult, you know, beloved cult figure as he is as a filmmaker. He, of course, was one of my heroes from an early age because of, you know, my transformative experience with The Evil Dead. So I am ride or die for him. But I will say that I understand a lot of the criticisms of Spider-Man 3, especially at the time that it was released. You know, it is a very busy film. It is a very jam-packed movie where, you know, it's got so much going on that you almost, when you're watching it, kind of really want it to slow down just a little bit. Be like, can you just take a little bit longer on this part, please? Because this is good, but we're rushing past it because we have to get to this or that or this. So I understand that, you know, and then of course there's other criticisms that I don't understand, which is, you know, some of the film's humor, which I feel like some people were really put off by, which was bizarre to me because I was like, well, did you watch the first two films? Because the Raimi humor is still there. But of course it went to a peak with the dance sequence. Yeah, I think that, again, similar to Godfather 3, I know I keep comparing the two, and the reason why is because I feel like they function in a similar way, which is that after the high of Spider-Man 2 of, you know, again, this guy fighting for what he believes in and fighting to be just recognized and vindicated, as the Dashboard Confessional song goes, that, you know, he's reached this peak, and true to Raimi's fashion, because Raimi is a guy who loves to abuse his characters and loves to tear them down a peg or two. You know, he puts this guy on a pedestal at the beginning of Spider-Man 3, I'm talking about Peter Parker, and says, okay, kid, like, you're at the top now, you're well-regarded, you've got the girl, you've got the, you know, superhero life, you're making it work, but you're so in love with yourself and in love with your victory that we need to take you down a peg. And it takes him down several pegs. And, you know, this is kind of, this is, for me, this is the responsibility part of the Spider-Man equation, as in when great power comes great responsibility, where if Spidey has achieved the great power, then this is the responsibility of, like, you have to be vigilant in terms of, you know, making sure that these loose ends that you've left are taken care of. And if they're not, they're going to come back to bite you in the ass or throw a goblin bomb at you. You know, you have to understand how to forgive, you know, this guy who supposedly killed your uncle. You have to understand not to abuse your girlfriend, you know. So this is some kind of heady stuff cooked into this, you know, really wild, crazy, stylistic film. So it's a big stew. But I think that, you know, the more I look at it, the more I really appreciate what he was trying to stuff in there.
Bill, I'm going to put some dirt in your eye.
Bully Maguire.
No, I love Spider-Man 3, actually. It's right outside my top five. Nice. I'm a big fan of Spider-Man 3. I mean, it's definitely my least favorite of the Raimi trilogy, but I feel like people are way too hard on it, and I really do believe it's because of how great Spider-Man 2 was. like Spider-Man 2 had left such a big impression on everyone, even the non-comic book superhero fans, that they were so excited to see where Raimi was going to go with Spider-Man 3. They're like, is it going to be on the same level? Is it going to be somehow better? Like, where is it going to go? And yeah, obviously it wasn't as good as Spider-Man 2, but I still loved a lot of aspects. Sure, it definitely felt a little cluttered. Sure, it did feel like there was a lot going on. And it is unfortunate what happened with how he wasn't able to do Spider-Man 4. Sony was trying to get him to go in directions that he didn't want to do himself. It's really unfortunate. But we obviously then got the Andrew Garfield films, and then we got the Tom Holland films, which it was so exciting to see Toby back as the character. Like, it felt like it hadn't been that long. Yeah. Since we last saw him, it was 14 years since we had last seen him as that character, but it felt like it had only been maybe like 4 months. It Wow. didn't even feel 14 years. And I love the emotional cathartic side of Spider-Man 3. I love that the stakes are really high here, especially in that last act, the last fight where Peter and Harry team up and get defeat all the villains and everything. I will say that my least favorite aspect of this, and I don't know if you could agree with this or disagree with this, but I liked Topher Grace as an actor. I never really bought him as Venom. I thought he was a good Eddie Brock, but I didn't really see him as Venom. And that's how I feel with Tom Hardy's Venom, where I don't really buy him as Eddie Brock, but I think he's a perfect person to play Venom. Yeah. So I think if the roles were swapped, it'd be much different. But all memes aside, I really do enjoy Spider-Man 3. And you know what? The memes are fun to watch.
They are.
I'm entertained when I watch the movie. And what would you say is your favorite line in the movie? Like, meme line or jokey line? Like, what would you say is your favorite line in the movie?
The first one that always comes to my mind is where it stops during the dance sequence to get, I think, a close-up of Toby's lips. And he says, now take on this.
Now take on this.
What a fucking dork. And snap.
Oh my god, that's so great. That's great. Oh, I love it so much. One of the moments that makes me laugh is after he leaves the cafe after talking to Harry, then all of a sudden the bus passed by and he's just gone. And yeah. I'm like, that makes no sense. But it's good. I love Spider-Man 3. I don't care what anyone says. The haters can hate all they want, but they're not going to stop me from loving the movie. I love it. I love Spider-Man 3. My number 3... Again, a completely different film from Spider-Man 3. We're going from a superhero film to a romance film. The kind of film that you never thought would even get sequels, but here we are. My number 3 is Before Midnight from 2013.
Oh, come on now. Oh, man. I know we weren't supposed to compare these, but it's like, if you gave me Spider-Man 3 Before Midnight on a desert island, I'd be like, oh, I'm sorry, Spider-Man. Godspeed, Spider-Man.
Godspeed, Spider-Man. See you, chump. Before Midnight, I love Richard Linklater. He's one of my favorite filmmakers of all time. I have always loved the work that he's done. And I was a little late to the Before trilogy. About a little less than 10 years ago, I sat down one day and I was like, I have a lot of free time. What am I going to do? I'm going to watch the Before trilogy. I'm going to binge all 3 movies, spend the day with Jesse and Celine, and just enjoy myself. And my God, I mean, I just have to commend that this is one of the best trilogies of all time. Maybe the best trilogy I've seen, because quite frankly, I mean, I don't think anyone expected that we would get 2 sequels to Before.
Including them, I think, right?
Yeah. Oh, you know? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And, you know, I loved the approach of how they did it every 9 years and seeing the growth of them, not only as people, but as actors too, because they were both so young when they started this trilogy and Before Sunrise. Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy were only in their mid-20s. And by the time that the third one came out, they were in their early to mid-40s. They had started families, they had gotten married, they had kids, like they had their own different perspectives on everything, their careers, their personal lives. And Before Midnight, again, it's similar to how when you watch the first 3 Harry Potters, of how they're so different from one another. Each Before film is so drastically different that when you watch Before Midnight, you would not even think it's the same characters as Before Sunrise, because they're so different. you know, the first movie they meet on a train and then they just spend the night talking before sunset. They reunite 9 years later to reconnect and everything. And now before midnight, they're together. They have kids. They're older. And so much has happened. And I love how realistic the approach to this trilogy is when it comes to the romance, because my thing is with a romance movie, I do love myself a cheeky rom-com, a sappy little romance movie. I enjoy those every once in a while, but these kinds of raw, realistic romances are my favorite romances to watch on screen. And I've dabbled with Eternal Sunshine and this trilogy to be my favorite romance presented on screen, but I really do believe that this is the best depiction of romance ever put to screen. Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy are both incredible together and separately as Jesse and Celine. Some of the best work that they've ever displayed is in this trilogy of films. Before Midnight, the fact that we don't exactly know what's going to happen with their relationship, just by one major fight where they just let it all out, and then Celine's like, "You stupid American man." It's so good. I love it so much. And the final sequence where they're just sitting outside on the pier, I guess, with all the tables and everything overlooking the country. It's really beautiful, and the writing in this entire trilogy is impeccable. Before Sunset is still my favorite of the trilogy. I think that one will always be my favorite, but there's no wrong answer when picking your favorite because all three of these films are masterpieces in my opinion. And I love that both this and Before Sunset got nominations for Best Screenplay because I really do believe that these are two pitch-perfect screenplays. They do what they need to do. You're engrossed with the characters. The films are paced really, really well. They fly by really quickly. I could watch 3 hours of these two just talking it up about anything, like literally anything. And I know there have been reports about how there may be a fourth one down the road. I mean, they kind of missed their mark because they passed the 9 year mark because it would have come out last year in 2022 if they were doing it every 9 years. But if they do a Scenes from a Marriage approach where they make Scenes from a Marriage, then they do like a sequel 30 years later, I would be really interested in that. But I really don't think there should be any more in this Before series unless Richard Linklater, Julie Delpy, and Ethan Hawke come up with a great story, which I'm sure they've had many discussions about. But Julie Delpy recently confirmed that like there's no way that we're gonna do another one. Never say never, of course, but we feel it's best to leave it where it is. And I agree. I think Before Midnight is a fantastic film. I think the Before trilogy is absolutely wonderful. I can understand that these are films that may not appeal to everybody because it's just talking. There's a lot of talking, and I can understand that dialogue-driven movies aren't everyone's cup of tea. I love myself a good dialogue-heavy piece. I love seeing people just talk and talk and talk. And when the writing is good and when the acting is good, then you pretty much nailed it. Then you gave me what I looked for in a dialogue-heavy movie. So Before Midnight is my number three. I'm gonna assume it's not on your list, but I'd be curious to
Because
hear
I'm
your
not
thoughts
cool
on
enough,
Before
Brian. You
Midnight.
outclassed me here. Wait, hold on. I'm just writing in on my new list, Three Colors Red. There you go. Ah, take that. No, gosh, the Before films, I love what you said there, where it's like, yeah, there's a lot of people that don't love dialogue-driven films. I would, in my view, use these films as exhibit A of like, here's what dialogue-driven movies can be. And here's why they're great, because there is such an amazing amount of tension in each of these movies for different reasons at different points. You know, at different points, you're talking about romantic tension, sexual tension, philosophical tension. And then, of course, when you get into the later films, relationship tension. And then, like you said, in Midnight, it breaks out into that fight that is just absolutely riveting, you know, in a way that just pulls you, each movie, it feels like it pulls you through the movie. You know, you're just following them almost literally in some cases. And it's just a fantastically emotional and rich and ultimately just incredibly engaging ride, you know, in a way that I think people, if you just put it on paper, like, yeah, it's two people, they talk the whole movie. They're like, oh, well, that sounds terrible, you know? So I think that these are really great exhibits and great, you know, demonstrating what these kind of, you know, works can be instead of just, oh, it's people talking.
How would you feel if they made a fourth one out of curiosity?
I, if they were doing that, I feel like they probably would have a good reason, you know, and it would be, okay, we feel like we have something to say about not just Jesse and Celine, you know, at this point in their lives, but like this point, because again, each before film feels to me like not an encapsulation of everybody's life, of course, how could it be? But just, you know, here's kind of, you know, a life in chapters and stages, if you will, you know, of, you know, this is stage A, stage B, stage C. So there, of course, could be a stage D. And, you know, if they were able to, between themselves, figure out what that could be and what they would want to say about that, I would have to watch it, you know. But as you say, if it was just, oh, well, it's been 10 years, you know, I guess we should, you know, then, yeah, don't bother. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, definitely. And now we get into our top two. This mm-hmm. is going to be so fascinating. We don't have any films in common yet, but I'd be really curious to know if we're going to have any in common here. So what is your second favorite threequel of all time?
This probably isn't it.
Probably not.
Common one. Okay, but I hopefully you'll appreciate. It is Die Hard with a Vengeance. So I'm a huge, you know, Die Hard nut, except for the last two, because they're terrible. Sorry. You know, Die Hard 2 is infamously a Rennie Harlan film. It's very kooky and has its pleasures, but it is very, very early 90s. So almost as a course correct, they brought back the original director, John McTiernan, for Die Hard with a Vengeance, and turned what was apparently supposed to be a Lethal Weapon sequel script at one point into a Die Hard movie. Mm. But they changed the setting. You know, this wasn't going to be in L.A. or kind of Washington, D.C. as the sequel was. This was in New York City. And I lived in New York for about 15 years. And Die Hard with a Vengeance is unequivocally one of my favorite New York City movies, in the sense that there's so many movies set in famous cities, you know, New York, L.A., Boston, Chicago, where they'll use the trappings, but it feels like the writers and the filmmakers didn't really understand the city. They were just like, oh, well, you know, the Empire State Building's over there and blah, blah, blah. Die Hard with a Vengeance really has a lid on its geography, which is really fantastic for me. When you're talking about a story where John McClane is running around the city having to defuse, you know, these bombs set by mad bomber Jeremy Irons. And along the way, he has to bring Samuel Jackson in tow because Samuel Jackson's character is a mechanic, I think, or electronics guy who works in Harlem, and you know sees that there's this altercation going on with John out there, and that's part of you know Jeremy Irons' evil, dastardly plan, and then gets caught up in the whole mix and has to kind of run around with John all day and solve riddles and put water into different jugs and, you know, figure out who the 42nd or 32nd or some number president was. And all the while there's, you know, gunplay, there's fist fighting, there's suspense, there's this huge heist that happens underneath the city where all this gold is taken from the vaults. And it's a really, for me, fantastic action movie made out of moving parts. It's constantly on the move. You know, it's part and parcel of the structure of the movie, but I really love that that feeling is behind it the whole way, where once the thing starts, like, it doesn't stop. It's interesting that it takes the quote-unquote diehard formula of John McClane trapped in a location having to solve problems with terrorists and turns that location into an entire city. So it doesn't feel claustrophobic anymore, but it still has that centrality of time, place, and action, you know, so it has that immediacy that I think comes with the Die Hard film. And for me, it's the last great Die Hard film, you know, because the following couple sequels, ooh boy. so this one for me is kind of where the series ends, if I'm using my own headcanon. But I think it's really proof in the pudding that, you know, the McClane character and the Die Hard concept had more juice in it than just one perfect film, you know, the first film.
Yeah, Die Hard with a Vengeance is one that I've only seen one time. I'm not as on top of the Die Hard franchise as other action franchises, but I love the first one, of course. The second one, you know, it has its moments for sure. This one is a massive step up from Die Hard 2, and I really do believe it is because the banter between Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson, I think they work off each other like magic. It's so good. The chemistry between the two of them is palpable. And Jeremy Irons is a fantastic villain, and I love how in the 90s it's like, oh, Jeremy Irons always plays these villains. It's like, oh, we're going to cast him as the evil lion, and then we're going to cast him as the evil guy in an action sequel. So I think it's really cool that they had him come on to this, and I do love that John McTiernan came back to direct this. I think that's really the reason why this worked as well as it does, because it does make me wonder how would the second one have worked if he had directed it. Would it have been better? Could it have been the same? Would it have been worse? We don't know, but I didn't realize that this was essentially like a Lethal Weapon script, and then they changed it up to be a Die Hard script. And yeah, it's definitely different from the first Die Hard. Like, you could tell that they're very different from one another, even though they have the same character headline in the film. But yeah, that's a really good answer. It's a solid action sequel. It's a solid sequel, period. And it's a solid film as well. So I'm going to be tremendously shocked if this is not your number one. But to be honest, at this rate, I don't think it is even on your list, which is really, really disappointing, because this is regarded as one of the best sequels of all time. Not just threequels, but one of the best sequels of all time. It was one of the many great films that started off the 2010s. This was a film that received so much acclaim, so much box office success. Nobody wanted this film originally. Everyone was like, why do we need this film when we already have two perfect films? But then you realize, don't underestimate the studio that put this out. Don't underestimate the actors. Don't underestimate the director. Toy Story 3 is so much better than it had any right to be. But then again, you realize there's a reason why this film was made, and everybody saw it. Everybody loved it. I'm sure there's one person out there that somehow hates this movie. And for the person out there that hates this movie, I'm sorry, you have no heart. I can understand. Like, I know
he needs lots of hugs. He needs lots of hugs.
Yeah, I'll send lots of to give you hugs. So I understand that you don't have to love everything that is universally beloved by everybody, but how could you not love Toy Story 3? I mean, how could you not love the Toy Story trilogy to begin with? I think the reason why a lot of people regard this as one of the best sequels is because when you're a kid and you have all these toys and then you grow apart from them, you start to realize, like, growing up is what everyone's meant to do. And, you know, this movie, it does so much so beautifully. I mean, first of all, the animation is gorgeous. It's such a step up from those first two movies, but I mean, the animation was upped when the fourth one came out. Of course, it makes sense, but just going on to this third one, I mean, I grew up watching the first two Toy Story films religiously when I was younger, and I remember when the third one came out, it was like an event. It was essentially like the Super Bowl. Everybody was talking about Toy Story 3. Everyone was going to see Toy Story 3 opening weekend. All these people that were kids, like kids or teenagers when those first two came out, were now adults going to see Toy Story 3. And I could tell you that I was 12 when Toy Story 3 came out. I could tell you that on my screen, there was a mix of literally everybody. There were kids younger than me. There were kids my age. There were young adults. And then there were adults bringing their children to go see this. And Toy Story is such a universal franchise because it's able to cater towards everybody of all ages. And that's the beautiful thing about this entire franchise, is that it gives you the humor that kids are going to enjoy, but it also subtly throws in jokes that kids will not understand. Then on top of that, you have the colorful animation, you have the fun characters to watch their journeys, and you have a really impressive story. And the fact that Andy's all grown up and he's about to go to college, and then all these toys are being shipped to daycare and they're trying to get back to him. it's really, it's, you know, it's a fun movie to watch, but it also knows how to tug at the heartstrings. Everyone's been talking about this for the last 13 years since this movie came out. That incinerator scene still keeps me up at night. All jokes aside, I mean, when I saw the movie for the first time, I was crying my eyes out. I really did not know what they were going to do. I had a feeling that they weren't going to off them, but my God, I didn't think that Pixar had the balls to do something like that. I really didn't. I'm like, there's no way. There's no way, because the entire movie from here on out was, like, fun, lovely. Like, yeah, there were moments of tension, but, like, this was, like, on a whole other level for a family movie. And, you know, the sequence where they just all embrace themselves as they're going down the incinerator and, you know, they think that's it. It's like, oh, my God, like, we've literally watched these characters for however many years, and then that might be it. And then... then the last scene happens where Andy gives his toys to Bonnie, goes through all of them, plays with them, and he leaves. So long, partner. Movie wraps up. Tears flowing down my eyes. I mean, I still think that this is one of the best sequels ever made. It was in my top five films of the 2010s. It was very high for me. I loved it so much in 2010. And then even as an adult, I still love these films. I rewatched the first three right before Toy Story 4 came out, which, fittingly enough, there was a Toy Story film at the start of the decade, and then there was a Toy Story film at the end of the decade, so I thought that was really fascinating. And I really am impressed with what Leon Gridge and the entire team was able to do with Toy Story 3. The voice performances are great. All the actors that jumped back into their roles, like, they jumped back like they hadn't been gone for that long. Tom Hanks, Tim Allen, all those actors, they did great. But then the new additions here were really, really great. Ned Beatty as Lotso, fantastic villain. Very, very engrossing character. But the standout of the film, 1,000%, has to be the always great Michael Keaton as Ken. Now, look, I know that in a couple of months, Michael Keaton will no longer be regarded as the best Ken on screen, which is really sad. You know, it was a title that he held for 13 years.
How great
years
would it be if he turned up in Barbie, though?
Oh, my God. That would be, you know, I didn't even think that that could be a possibility, but that would be incredible. And I would literally be like, Greta Gerwig, you are now my favorite human being on the planet. Not that she isn't already, but, like, now she would get more points if she – that's a – oh, my God. If someone out there hasn't tweeted that, then they're crazy. You just gave me a great idea. So
you,
I appreciate that.
You go for it.
But no, I love Toy Story 3. I love the Toy Story series. I am a big fan of Toy Story 4 as well. Did we need it? No. Was it the best thing in the world? No. But I think for a film that I had pretty low expectations for and to be pleasantly surprised, I'm really happy with. I don't want to make a Toy Story 5, but then part of me feels like they're going to make it, then it's going to be good. But it's like, we really don't need it. We didn't need a Toy Story 4. And that turned out to be good. But then, again, a lot of people are like, we didn't need a Toy Story 3. And look how that turned out. It's regarded as one of the best anime films of all time. And a lot of people do consider that to be the end of the Toy Story franchise. And not only did it win the Oscar for Best Anime Feature, it was also the third, and unfortunately, it's the most recent anime film to be nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars. It's so disappointing that we haven't gotten an anime film nominated in that category since Toy Story 3. So I'm really hoping that something changes to where we could get an anime film appear in that Best Picture lineup again now that they're back to nominating 10 films in the category. So I love Toy Story 3 so much. I mean, what could you say about it that hasn't been said already? It's funny, it's charming, it's likable, it's heartfelt, it's heartbreaking. So many emotions throughout. It's a really fantastic film. And those are my thoughts on Toy Story 3. So what are your opinions on Toy Story 3?
Undersigned. Ditto. You know? I mean, it's one of the most remarkable animated films, but also threequels. And to the point where I will forever remember sequences from Toy Story 3. And a lot of my mind is blank on Toy Story 2. So I'd almost say that past the first Toy Story, it's the most essential, maybe even over the first Toy Story. I don't know. I mean, you kind of have to have the first to have the third have the impact that it does. But I think that it's you know, something that when I was watching it for the first time, and this is something that I'm an easy weeper at movies. You know, if something's really emotional, you know, I tap into my acting training and then it's like, oh, I'm a little weepy, I'm a little misty-eyed. But, like, I did not expect this to have the huge emotional impact that it does on every level. Not just, oh, I'm crying, but, you know, oh, wow, I feel profoundly moved, you know, which is something that I think the rarest of movies do, you know, live action animation or not. So I think that this is a really special film in a lot of ways. It's also just, you know, over the, you know, the huge richness of it, it's just a really fun movie too. You know, it's just a visual treat. And like you were saying, all these characters that are introduced are delightful, you know? So it's something that there's so much richness in it and there's so much to discover in it. It's something that I think I would love to see come back in a big way to family entertainment. You know, not to disparage recent movies, but the certain recent movies that I've seen that are supposedly family entertainment, I didn't even leave feeling angry at or you know, disappointed with. I just felt bland. I walked out of the mm-hmm. theater and went, I forgot already. I forgot what mm-hmm. I just saw, you know? Yep. And I think that you can't hit a home run every time out. We know this, but it would be nice to see a little bit more effort, you know, to have absolutely. A bit more richness in entertainment. And Toy Story 3 is a pinnacle.
100%. 100%. So it's crazy. We have no films in common. Because
I'm surprised my number one is not on your list, but
I'm surprised that my number one is not on your list either. So, okay. So okay. What is your favorite threequel of all time?
All right. Well, I have to preface this. So when you gave me this assignment for this podcast of, you know, let's talk about threequels, and, you know, I put in my head, that put my, you know, gears to rolling of like, okay, what is it about threequels? What started this whole process of, you know, this colloquial or conventional wisdom that, oh, the third movie, it sucks, you know? And I went back to what I feel was the core of that problem. And I thought about it and I thought, you know what though? I've always loved that movie. There's never been a time where I've been, oh, that one's not good. So why didn't I choose it? And it's Return of the Jedi.
Mm.
And, you know, I think you can make a huge argument for that film being the patient zero of, you know, this conventional wisdom that's gone since, you know, we're celebrating its 40th anniversary this year, Return of the Jedi. So for 40 years, there's been in fan circles this notion of, oh, the third movie, you know, boo. That was a thumbs down. I realized this is a podcast, not a video. But ever since I was a kid, when I first saw Jedi, of course, you know, I know that there's a crux, you know, with Jedi in terms of the Ewoks, in terms of, oh, those Ewoks. Oh, boy, we just can't stand those Ewoks. Look, I understand in terms of a, you know, all serious, you know, let's really, you know, oh, let's take Star Wars super seriously. The Ewoks are cute. They're funny. They're goofy. They're also kind of neat, though, I feel, in terms of just the way that they use these tools to defeat the Empire. I'm like, hey, you know, that's kind of a great meta joke on the Empire of like, here you have this technological wonder and they're taken down by these, you know, teddy bears. Beautiful. You know, that just what a fitting end for these fascists. But more importantly, you know, in terms of the opening with Jabba's palace, you know, I thought that's just such a greatly constructed sequence where all the characters are reintroduced in interesting ways, you know, Leia in her costume and, you know, trying to save Han, and Lando's over here, and, you know, Chewie's, you know, over there. And of course, you know, everyone's coming in kind of either in disguise or having a different kind of motive or plan, all coming together with the sail barge battle, which is great. And then this through line that Luke has in the movie and his confrontation with the Emperor and Darth Vader. First of all, I think Ian McDiarmid as the Emperor is pitch perfect casting. I mean, what a great English actor who's given this huge role in the third movie of a trilogy and knocks it out of the park in terms of just being pure evil with just this, you know, terrible voice that you'll always remember. Skywalker, you know, I mean, just intonations that are just insane. And it's something that I feel like the movie doesn't spend a ton of screen time on, you know, what is the culminating events of the trilogy, which is, you know, Luke's path to the Jedi, Luke's confrontation with his father now that he knows Darth Vader's his father, and, you know, tussle with the dark side or light side of the Force. And yet it feels complete to me, and it feels honest, and there's so much richness in it that I get out of it. Whereas, you know, I feel like if this movie had been made 20 years, 30 years later, it would have been at least twice as long and half as interesting. And so I think that it's a movie that does what it has to do in a really economical way, in a really entertaining way. And it's something that for the longest time, you know, before the prequels, Star Wars felt complete. And I think there's a reason for that.
I really like Return of the Jedi a lot. It's obviously my least favorite of the original trilogy. I think that's a very universal thing. But, I mean, it wrapped up everything beautifully. And, you know, imagine if you watched those films when they came out 40 years ago, and then you're like, oh, this is it. This is it. And then you watch, you know, the prequels when they wrap, and you're like, this is it. There's no more. And then you watch the sequel trilogy, and you're like, oh, great, whoopee. But, no, I really like Return of the Jedi a lot, and it's crazy. 40 years, that's absolutely nuts that it's that old. And, you know, I did almost consider putting the Star Wars film on here. I was debating between Return of the Jedi or Revenge of the Sith, which I am a huge fan of. I love Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah, but, no, that's, I think, valid, too.
But Rise of Skywalker would have steered clear from this list because that film sucks. I'm sorry to anyone out there who likes it, but that film, garbage. So, I kind of figured that your number one was going to be a Star Wars film as the episode was progressing. I'm like, well, when he said that he didn't put Lord of the Rings on his list, I knew right away that I was going to be very sad. Return of the King to me is the best threequel ever made. That is my number one.
I did already say it was a masterpiece, I believe. I put that on record.
You did say it was a masterpiece. Yeah. You did say that. But... and your reasons were valid for not putting it on, but at the same time, another part of me is like, this fucking guy, I can't believe what he's doing. Return of the King, I mean, the entire Lord of the Rings trilogy is masterful filmmaking. Like, the technical achievement that Peter Jackson placed in front of our eyes is really unprecedented, and something that, quite frankly, we may never see again in blockbuster filmmaking. We've obviously gotten so many franchises that have tried to capture what Peter Jackson did with Lord of the Rings, but all these filmmakers have failed tremendously because they're not able to bring to life their stuff like the way that Peter Jackson was able to bring J.R.R. Tolkien's story to life. And I think Return to Cain is masterful in every possible stretch of the imagination. The directing is incredible. The writing is so impressive because you have all these stories going on. You're going back and forth from one story to another, and there's multiple of them. There's so many. It's not like it's just one or two. There's three or more stories that are happening in this movie, and there's a reason why these movies are as long as they are. And I know that to some people, lengthy films just aren't the best. I can't watch a 3.5 hour long movie, and yet you could sit down and watch all 8 episodes of Stranger Things in one sitting. Get the fuck out of here, seriously. But that's no diss to Stranger Things. I love Stranger Things. But what I really appreciate,
just because you're on that topic, I have to interject this.
Yes.
When I was working at Hollywood Video during college, and Return of the King was out on video, somebody came by, and this asshole, he was like, you know, hey, because I was working behind the counter, and he was like, oh, you see that Return of the King? I'm like, yeah, it's fantastic. It's great. You should rent it. He's like, oh, yeah, I saw it too. And I'm like, okay, what'd you think? He's like, oh, it was a real sleeper. As in, he fell asleep during it. And I was like, get out. Get out of this door.
No, man.
What a jerk.
Yeah, everything about Return of the King is just so incredible to me. I really do commend the writing and the directing, but also the acting. You have to give a major round of applause to the entire ensemble of this trilogy. I mean, everyone delivers great performance one after the other. Like, everybody is great regardless of how big or small their screen time is in this trilogy. And the performance to me that has always stuck out in this entire trilogy has always been Sean Astin as Samwise Gamgee. And I think that as these films progressed, his acting got so much better, especially in Return of the King. I firmly believe, and I stand by this opinion, Sean Astin not only should have been nominated for an Oscar for Return of the King, I think he should have won an Oscar for Return of the King. The emotions that he brings in this performance, in this particular film, is really, really incredible. There's a reason why that one of the sequences in this trilogy that everyone talks about is when they're about to go up to Mount Doom. They're close to getting up there, but Frodo can't go on any longer. And he just says, "Come on, Mr. Frodo, I can't carry it for you, but I could carry you." And then the music swells and then he just lifts him up. And it's just so incredible. And it's like, fuck yeah, Samwise Gamgee. This is why you're the fucking man. Let's fucking go. It's so, so good. And God, all the action sequences on display here are masterful. It's really incredible how this series was able to blend practical effects with CGI, and the CGI is top-notch, and it still looks great. There are some flickers with the CGI. I recently rewatched these films. The Alamo Drafthouse showed the extended cuts of these movies, and I saw all three of them in theaters because I had never seen them on the big screen before, and I've always wanted to do that. And yeah, there are some visual effects that look a little dated, but for a series that's 20 years old, they look better than half of the films that come out nowadays. And that's saying a lot, especially with how far we've evolved with technology. So, yeah, I don't know what else I could really say about Return of the King. It wraps up everyone's stories beautifully. I know that there's like a billion endings to this movie. I know that's a common complaint with everybody with this movie, but I love the million endings that we get for this movie. And I love everything that it goes through. The last 10 minutes of the movie make me cry uncontrollably. The goodbyes in this movie, it just breaks my heart still to this day. Every single viewing I watch this movie, I get more emotional than ever before, which is saying a lot because I've seen all these movies like at least 10 times. And the fact that this film was a Best Picture recipient is also so cool to me. Because a lot of the time when you get a film that wins Best Picture, it's like such Oscar bait. It's the cliched biopic or based on a true story or the dramas and everything. And yes, this is a dramatic film, but this is also a big budget popcorn blockbuster film. And the fact that this won the highest prize in the film industry is really saying a lot. And it's really disappointing that we haven't gotten a big budget blockbuster to win in a war like this. I guess maybe the closest is maybe Everything Everywhere All at Once, where it's like kind of a popcorn flick, but it's also, you know, some art house type of movie. And I think it's really impressive that this film was able to sweep that entire Oscar ceremony. I know to some people that's boring because it's like, oh, the same film won every award. I get it. I understand that. But this is a very deserving winner. And it's a really cool winner. And I hope that down the road we get another fantasy film to win the highest prize in Hollywood. I'm hoping that we get a blockbuster to win. Let's start campaign for Dune Part 2 to sweep the Oscars next year and win Best Picture. Denis Villeneuve, Best Director. Dune Part 2, Best Picture. Austin Butler, Best Supporting Actor. I don't know. I'm just saying all these random things. But I love Return of the King so much. I mean, I don't really know what else I could say that hasn't been said these last 20 years about this movie, about this entire trilogy. The Lord of the Rings trilogy is such a staple to my life. I watched them for the first time when I was a teenager, and I've grown to love and appreciate this series so much. I don't hate the Hobbit films, but they're unfortunately not on the same level as this trilogy, but I think we all knew that going into them. And I haven't even bothered with the Amazon series. I know that it's not affiliated with these movies, but I tried. I watched the first episode, and it bored me to tears. It was so slow. It was so uninteresting. I couldn't make it through it. I just don't care. I'm happy for everybody that loves the show, but this guy right here does not appreciate that at all. But Return of the King, to me, is not only my favorite threequel of all time. I think it's the best threequel of all time. So, obviously, you've touched a little bit about your thoughts on Return of the King, but what are some additional thoughts that you want to give towards this film?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, it's kind of what you were saying. It's like, what else could you say about such a massive, massive achievement of a movie? I think that when you were talking about the multiple endings, which, of course, is the first topic that tends to come up with Return of the King, you know, in colloquial conversation, my thought on that has always been, if people are complaining about the endings, it's probably because at some level they're just not engaged. Because if you are engaged, those endings aren't even you know, they're not even extraneous. They're necessary. You know, it's like this movie and these films as a trilogy earned those endings, you know, in such a huge way that it is this extended catharsis that is just so tremendous and something that it's rare to see in storytelling, you know, whether it's TV, film, or, you know, novels, in terms of like having a story and characters that have earned such a climax, you know, and such a denouement. It's rare, you know, or like most of the times, yeah, even if you love something, if you're in love with a movie or a TV show or a book, it's like, okay, well, the end happens, time to leave, you know. But this is something that it just luxuriates in its finale, and it just deserves it, and it does it so well. And, you know, it won a lot of Oscars, but I think there was one Oscar category they needed to create for it, which is Best Tomato Eating. Denethor, man.
This film has one of my favorite close-ups of all time, when they're on top of the mountain, and he's just like, I could carry it for a while. Share the load, share the load, share the load. share the load. It's, share oh load. My God. Share the load. Don't you agree that he should have been nominated for an Oscar for this movie?
Yeah. It's surprising that he wasn't. Yeah.
You know, like...
It's actually kind of surprising that... I mean, I know that it won, my memory's not wrong, most of the awards or Oscars that it won was tech awards, right?
Mm-hmm. But yeah. It won all 11 it was nominated for.
It won all of them. But, I mean, it's like they were... And it's kind of shocking when you think back to the Lord of the Rings films, and especially King, you know... These movies really do live and die on their characters, you know?
They do.
So it's like, well, who brought those characters to life, folks? You mm-hmm. know?
I just love how Peter Jackson, like, yeah, he puts so much effort into the scope, but he also focused so much on the substance of the film. So I love that he puts so much effort into the characters, and obviously it's not just him, it's his co-writers, Fran Walsh and Philippa Boyens. They put so much love and craft into bringing these characters to life, and we really are never going to get anything like this ever again. We're never going to get anything on this level again. And I was talking about this with someone recently. I would love for Peter Jackson to direct another narrative. I think it's cool that he's now in that documentary filmmaking life. Like, I have not seen They Shall Never Grow Old, but I heard it's fantastic. I haven't seen that, but I love what I love what he did with Get Back. I thought that was fantastic. That was very engrossing. Long as fuck, but it was so engrossing. It was so great. As a huge Beatles fan, I loved what he did with that. And, you know, it's sad that the last narrative that he directed was the third Hobbit film. Like, it's really sad, too, where you see, like, how that trilogy took such a toll on him making it, because, like, he was in such good shape before he made the Hobbit films. Like, he barely got any sleep. There was all these last-minute things that were going on. He was working, like, 20-hour days, and I'm like, I can't even imagine. They never should have made The Hobbit into a trilogy. That's been a discussion for the last 10 years. Two movies would have been fine. That was their original plan from the start. But, yeah, that's a different discussion for another time. But, yeah, Lord of the Rings Return of the King is my favorite threequel of all time. So before we get into giving an honorable... So before we get into giving the shout-out to the films that didn't make the cut, let's recap our list from 5 to 1. So, Bill, what is your list?
Number 5, Godfather Part 3. Number 4, Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. Number 3, Spider-Man 3. Number 2, Die Hard with a Vengeance. And number 1, Return of the Jedi.
And to recap my list, coming in number 5 is Logan, number 4 is Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, number 3 is Before Midnight, number 2, Toy Story 3, and number 1, The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King. So that is it with our list, so let's give a shout out to some of the films that didn't make the cut. There's a lot of threequels that I want to give a shout out to, but before I give my shout outs, what are some of the honorable mentions that you want to mention?
Oh gosh, one of the ones that I was debating whether to put this one on or Halloween 3, and Halloween 3 won, was Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, which is a fantastic nightmare film.
It's so good.
And the one that arguably changed the entire series. It made the series in terms of, like, before, you know, the first film did well, the second not so much, and the third was such a huge moneymaker at the box office that it is the movie that you have to refer to in terms of the house that Freddy built, part of New Line Cinema. You know, so it's like, it's the one that changed the game literally for Freddy. And it's just such a fun, imaginative horror sequel. And it, there's so many things it does right, and there's so many exciting elements to it. For some reason, again, when I was thinking of action sequels, and it's funny because it's kind of a middle chapter. I know that, Brian, you said there was like, you know, prequels that are kind of feeling like a middle chapter, which mm-hmm. they're not the end and they're not the beginning. Yeah. One of my favorites is Lethal Weapon 3, because it's just a fun installment. It's not, you know, changing the game in any big way. Rene Russo's character shows up for the first time. That's the biggest change to it. Mm-hmm. But it's just got some really fun sequences, some great continuing banter between Danny Glover and Mel Gibson, and then Rene Russo is a great element, and Joe Pesci's still around from the second film. Gosh, there's so many. I think you said Revenge of the Sith already, but I think that's worth mentioning too. Yes. Where, you know, that's a really fantastic, dark, you know, interesting capper to George Lucas's time on Star Wars. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. You know, I think that is obviously a lot of people's second favorite indie film for a reason. You know, it's a really kind of back to format, you know, follow up to Raiders. Sean Connery is pitch perfect as his, you know, casting as Indy's dad. All the supporting characters are back from the Raiders. You just got a lot of great set pieces. You know, the Holy Grail is a pretty good thing for Indy to go after in terms of literal holy grails. So there's a couple. How about you?
Oh, man. So I have a whole list of ones. To go into some of horror films first, I mean, you brought Nightmare on Elm Street 3, which I really, really enjoyed. I love Patricia Arquette, so I'll watch her in anything that she's in. She's so good in that. Army of Darkness, I just did an Evil Dead marathon very recently because I hadn't seen any of them. And it's so, so good. You know, you brought up one Sam Raimi threequel, so I brought up another threequel that he directed. Obviously, Spider-Man 3, I'll mention that as well. I know that this is not technically an official trilogy, but in film geeks' hearts, we do consider the Cornetto trilogy to be a thing, and I love The World's End so much. So yeah. That almost made my top five list because I'm a huge fan of all those films. The Dark Knight Rises, I know, is very divisive among film fans and audiences, but I think it's a really solid conclusion to a pretty strong trilogy of films. In terms of some other superhero threequels, I really enjoyed Thor Ragnarok. I loved the humor that was utilized in that. I unfortunately was not a fan of Love and Thunder, but, you know, most people weren't, so that's fine. I'm glad to be on that same camp. Captain America Civil War was a huge game changer for the MCU, and it really set in stone for where the MCU was going to go from there. I liked the political thriller approach to it, and I really like how psychologically mind-bending it was too, especially with the stuff regarding Bucky and how what was going on with him and everything. This is a very silly one to include, but as a New Jerseyan, I felt it was my obligation to include Clerks 3, which just came out last year. I honestly liked it way more than I thought I was going to. I'm not a huge fan of Clerks. Clerks has never been the New Jersey film that I eat up, but it's really, really good. And Clerks 3, I mean, wrapped up everything really, really well. I was very impressed with that. Obviously, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, that's a great, great installment to the series. And, you know, if the fourth one hadn't come out, I think that would have been a great conclusion to the Indiana Jones series. I think it wrapped up everything really well. Obviously, like I brought up before, I'm very excited for the Dial of Destiny. I cannot wait to see how that pans out. The Bourne Ultimatum. I mean, this is a banger. This film, it kicks so much ass. The action in this is absolutely incredible. A lot of quick cuts.
Another great New York City movie.
Another great New York City movie, and Matt Damon kicks ass. And I think it's so funny that he had two threequels come out the same year. He had this and Ocean's 13 come out in the same year, which is so, so interesting. Ocean's 13 is another solid threequel. That's another really solid film, but it didn't make my honorable mentions because I've only seen it once. And the last one is very near and dear to my heart. And I know that everyone's going to be like, oh my God, they're going to roll their eyes being like, really? You're going to mention this film? Listen, you have to understand, as someone who was born in the late 90s, as someone who was like 10 years old when this movie came out, everybody in elementary school, middle school, and high school went to go see High School Musical 3 senior year, which, you know what? Look, you can make all the jokes you want. I love the High School Musical movies. They're very near and dear to my heart. I grew up in a Disney household, and I remember just watching the first two films the night that they premiered on Disney Channel. When I found out the third one was going to theaters, I was like, that's cool, that's awesome, because you watch the first two, they look like TV movies. This one looked like a film. It looked like a film. And where they went with it was really, really great. The songs are catchy. The performances are fun. A whole sequence where Zac Efron is walking up an upside down hallway. Listen, and Christopher Nolan saw High School Musical 3 and said, I need to do a rotating hallway sequence as well. So he stole it from High School Musical 3. And if anyone out there says that High School Musical stole it from Christopher Nolan, that's wrong, because High School Musical 3 came out before Inception. So Christopher Nolan is a secret High School Musical 3 fan. I will not argue with anyone that says that he isn't. So yeah, those are my honorable mentions. I love High School Musical 3. I'm
Wait,
sorry.
that's, you know what? You can't end it better. There you go.
Yes, we literally ended it with High School Musical 3 senior year. Great, great stuff. So, Bill, it was such a blast to have you on today. Thank you so much for coming on to Film Fragments to talk to me about our favorite threequels. I really had a great time chatting with you today.
Thank you, man. Me too.
Absolutely, absolutely. And where could people find you online?
I am on Twitter at Bill Bria, also Instagram, the same handle, and check out /film/BillBria as well.
I will put links for that in the description below. You guys can follow me on all social medias at Brian Suffield. You guys can subscribe to the show on any podcast platform of your choice. We have a Twitter and Instagram, so you guys can stay up to date with what's going on in Film Fragments. We have a lot of great episodes coming your way, so be on the lookout for that. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode. I really appreciate it. Let us know your favorite three calls. I'd be really curious to see your guys' list. And I will see you guys for the very next episode of Film Fragments. Take care, everybody.